Well, hello everyone. My name is David Everson and I'm a recovered alcoholic.
Hi, David.
And I am very grateful to be here and it's an honor. And thank you, Denise, for the invitation. My home group is the Vision for You. We meet on Thursday nights in Union, not far from here. My sponsor is Walter M., and my service sponsor is Wayne Ross. God separated me from alcohol on June 24th, 2007. I thank Denise, which I really greatly appreciate being here, and I also like to thank God, because God saved me from alcoholism, and God brought me to AA. And further extended from that, AA brought me back to God. And that was really profound for me, because I was searching and lost, and I thought there was just no hope for me at all. So I'm so thankful to my Creator. I'm a real alcoholic. I'm a guy that suffers from those three legs, all three of them equally, of our triangle of ailments, that mental obsession, that when alcohol is around, I'm thinking about it, and I just can't stop thinking about it. I can't try to put it out of my mind, but it just pops right back. It's just always on my mind, and it's just driving me. And if I take a drink, that craving, that phenomenon kicks in, and that first drink demands the second drink, which demands the next drink, and I don't know what my day is going to look like once my mind tells me to drink, and that's scary. And I suffer from a spiritual malady, where I feel different, I feel like I'm a loser, like I don't fit in, like I'm never going to amount to anything. And even if you're so nice to me, I'm thinking you're just saying that to be nice, you really don't mean it at all. It's really self-defeating. And I think the spiritual malady is what surfaced first for me. I'm the youngest of six in my family, born and raised on Staten Island, and had a happy childhood, lived on a little dirt road in Huguenot, went to PS5, and my next oldest sibling is my sister, and then all the rest are older brothers. So four brothers and one sister. And we had our little black and white TV, and watched Donna Reed and Father Knows Best, and looked forward to Mickey Mouse Club when I was a little kid, and all that. Just really good memories. But I just felt different. I felt like I was a misfit. I felt that I didn't really fit into my own family. I couldn't put my finger on why, but it was just there. Nobody told me that, but I had just a little, just back of my mind, this little thought saying, "You're a loser. You're never going to amount to anything." I thought when everybody was going around having a fun time, I would smile and I would participate, but it was all a front, because deep down inside, something just didn't feel right, and I was restless about that. And I realize now that that was my spiritual malady. God was not in our life when we were kids. We did not have any church life at all. My mom was a Roman Catholic, and my father was a Norwegian Pentecostal, and while all the kids were raised by agreement upon marriage to be raised in the Catholic Church, we went to public school and religious instruction, but once that communion was done and confirmation, boom, that was it. And we never went to church. And so I had that haunting me too, that I would talk with my friends at school and they would be talking about the priests and sisters, and I didn't even know who they were talking about. And so I felt more separate from and apart from and less than because of that. Not a fun place to be. Another example probably of that spiritual malady was, I remember when I was helping my dad, I don't know where my older brothers were, but I was helping my dad doing some cleaning around the house. It must have been on the weekend. And we were in the yard, and I remember we were down in the cellar, and I'm holding the dustpan for him at the end, and holding it while he's sweeping, and we got all done, and he patted me on the shoulder. He said, "Thank you very much, David. I really appreciate it." And I said, "Sure, Dad." And to this day, I can remember thinking, he's just saying that to be nice. He really doesn't mean it. And what kind of kid thinks like that? Another example is, I remember going to a parent-teacher's event at my school, PS5, which wasn't far from where we lived. And I remember the next day at school, my friend saying, "Wow, your parents are really old, man." Because my oldest brother is 16 years older than me. My parents were as old as their grandparents. So I had that lagging on me now, too, because I'm just feeling, oh, gee, now I'm ashamed of my parents. I'm embarrassed of my parents, who are wonderful people. But all that, the little voices, always talking. I found booze when I started in college in Colorado, joined a fraternity, which was good because I fit in there and I felt a part of and this brotherhood, and I was longing for that because I didn't have a lot of friends my age when I was a kid growing up. So that was neat. But a lot of drinking, a lot of beer, and keggers on the weekends and things like that. And some consequences, not a lot, but as time went on, they got worse and worse. Started drinking when I was about 18 years old, and took 37 years before I had my last drink, when I was brought to my knees back in June of 2007. So the consequences were in college. I remember being pulled over. I've been pulled over 4 times while drinking, while driving. In college, it was when they found out where I lived, it was just go home. Well, that was back in 1970. No ticket, no anything. Later on, after I graduated from college, I worked for the Boy Scouts of America in Colorado also. And it was a great job, and I loved it. And a buddy of mine was leaving to get into pharmaceutical sales. You make a lot more money on that, and a lot don't have the nightly meetings you have when you work for the scouting program because of volunteers. We have meetings a lot at night. And I remember we had a going away thing for him in Longmont, Colorado. And on the way home, of course, we're drunk, especially me. There were about 4 or 5 of us there at dinner, and then we just really got ripped. And I'm driving home. Now I'm pulled over by the Colorado Highway Patrol, and I'm behind the back of my car and doing this with my fingers, you know, all this stuff. And the police officer wants to see the license and registration, and he sees Long's Peak Council, Boy Scouts of America, and he starts screaming at me, reading me the right. I look at you. Supposed to be a leader, an example for young kids, and here you are drunk on your butt. Didn't say butt on the side of the highway. You should be ashamed of yourself. And he went on and on and on. He asked me what I was doing out there, and I told him about Steve, my colleague, who resigned. We're having a going away thing for him. He says, where's he live? So Steve told him, he says, well, get the blank home. Didn't say blank. He was mad. Found out later from Steve that the guy was an assistant scoutmaster for a Mormon scout troop. No wonder he was furious. His kids are in a scouting program. That's the youth program of the LDS Church. And here I am, drunk in my butt on the side of the highway. But it gave him a good impression of the Boy Scouts of America, thanks to me. But no ticket, but a lot of shame. But it still didn't stop me. Moved on to California because I did go, finally left and went into the scouting profession and went into pharmaceutical sales myself. And I got a job in San Diego for a Swiss company named Sandoz, and which later merged with Ciba Geigy in the 90s, became Novartis. And I had that job for 19 years, and it was a great job. You call on 7-8 doctors a day. You explain about your products. We encourage the doctor to write prescriptions for you. You leave samples. You see those sample guys when you go to the doctors. That's what I was doing. And the rest of the day is yours. Great salary, full benefits. You can make half again your salary and commission. And it was great. All that freedom. For me, freedom to make my calls and go home and kick back and drink beer. And on it went. Well, during those 19 years, I had 2 arrests for drunk driving by the California Highway Patrol and spent 2 nights in the Vista County Jail in northern San Diego County. The first conviction cost about almost $1,000. So that was back in 1985. And the second one was at noon in 2000, while I was trying to hustle and make a doctor's call in before noon. So I'm drunk anyway, and I'm speeding. And, of course, now I'm arrested again and another night in the Vista County Jail. That case didn't come to fruition because it turned out that the police officer was killed by a drunk driver the following week. And my lawyer, who then cost about $1,800 just walking in the door, said, hell, they have no case. There's no arresting officer. He was ecstatic about it. I was crushed. A guy like me killed the guy doing his job. So on it went. Consequences of my drinking went on, and as I already indicated, I'm drinking during the day even, And so oftentimes I couldn't even go out my front door because I realized it was already 10 o'clock in the morning and I've had so many screwdrivers that anybody could smell the vodka in my breath. So I was making up, fudging when I was calling on people and playing that game that I'm going to catch up. And anyway, I was given the invitation to resign or be fired after 19 years. So I knew I had a problem with alcohol, but I could not admit it to anybody. Wouldn't admit it. Too much pride, too much ego, too much fear. And the consequences were big in my relationships with friends, co-workers, my family, my girlfriends. All the girlfriends I've had, so many of them, we broke up because my drinking became an issue. And I was arrogant about that. Well, my dad died in 2000. And my family was after me to come back to New Jersey because my folks left Staten Island in the late 90s and moved out to Western New Jersey to come home and take care of my mom because she was in her 90s and in a walker. And I fought that and fought that because all I did was sit out in California and just drink in San Diego. And finally, after 6 months, I came back to New Jersey. The idea was me taking care of mom. We look back, we wonder who was taking care of who because all I did was drink. And didn't look for work. Who would hire me? I had started having some health problems, lost a lot of weight, and shakes all the time, booze, and it just got worse and worse. And I hated what I saw when I looked in the mirror. And all the frothy emotional appeal from my siblings, especially my mom, did a lot of praying for me, about what she could do to help me and all that. And I said, I know, Mom, I'll cut down, I'll stop. But I could not stop. But something was blocking me from asking for help. I just couldn't do it. Couldn't make that step because that would be weak. A little weak. Look at what I did with my life, for crying out loud. And on June 24, 2007, they found me in the bedroom of my mother's home in a pool of blood because I had a grand mal seizure and had bit a slit, crescent-shaped slice out of my tongue. And I remember being on the floor in my mom's family room, and there were a lot of people in uniforms, paramedics and police officers, and they were talking about me and to me and all that. And off at a distance, I could hear my mom. And everything was in a fog. And I woke up. I was in a hospital bed in Bethlehem, Pennsylvania, in St. Luke's Hospital. And I've got all these tubes and a tracheotomy, and I heard a voice saying, "You're done." And I believe that voice was God. And I knew he meant it. Because I knew I was done. I had nowhere else to go. And now I'm ready. I've got the desperation of a drowning man. I need help. And my best friend from high school came out to see me because they didn't know if I was going to make it. My sister told me later when I was making amends that night she was calling all my siblings, and she called we have a niece who's a PharmD, and she was at the time at Johns Hopkins University, and she told my sister, "Well, Uncle David will either bleed out and die tonight, or he'll start to get better." I had ulcerated my esophagus so bad from the vodka that I wonder, they think that's what triggered the seizures. So now I'm in a hospital bed and nowhere to go, but I mentioned my friend from high school. He came out to visit me, and I remember seeing him from the hospital bed, and he had told my sister and my brother Gene, "See if you can get him to Graymore." So St. Christopher's Inn. It's a treatment center for alcoholics and drug addicts in Garrison, New York. And it's run by the Franciscan Friars of the Atonement. And they've been in business about 106 years now. And they never turn anybody away, regardless of ability to pay. And it took a while, a lot of phone calls, a lot of prayers, but I was taken to St. Christopher's in July of 2007, and I was there about 100 days, a little over 100 days. We had an AA meeting every night, and I started to get well, a little bit, little by little. They try and instill in you at St. Christopher's that you're a good person and you're worthy of love and respect. And I sure didn't feel that way about myself at all. I mean, it was the bottom of the bottom. I couldn't look anybody in the eye. I could barely walk. My skin was all gray. I had the tracheotomy that I mentioned, and my balance was terrible, and it was bad. Well, after St. Christopher's, I was accepted into a sober house in Mountainside, an Oxford house. So that's when I started coming to meetings in Westfield and Summit and Springfield and Berkeley Heights. And requirements in that sober house was that zero tolerance, of course, for drug or alcohol. If they think you're dirty and you're tested, you're out. I had no place to go. Pay your rent every Friday, and you're expected to be active in either NA or AA, they don't care which, and pitch in around the house. And I was there about 4 years, 3.5 years. But those guys got me to a meeting every day, and I'm grateful for that. And I started to learn more about AA. I wasn't driving because of the seizure, didn't have a job, but the guys at those house were a tremendous blessing to me, and I knew it at the time, too, and I appreciated it. Well, we were at a workshop. We used to go, one of the meetings we'd go to was a workshop, and it was, I believe it was in Woodbridge, that was put on by this guy named Peter Rem. And we'd go there, I think it was a Tuesday, we'd go every week, and one of the guys said, that's the guy you should ask to sponsor you, because I didn't have a sponsor or anything. And I finally got some courage, and I went up to him about a week or so later, and I asked him if he'd sponsor me, and he says, well, I work with several guys at a time, but in a few weeks I'll be freed up a little bit, why don't we talk then? And I said, okay. So a few weeks later, I went up to him, and he says, okay, you got a job? I said, no. Do you drive? I said, no. They told him about the seizure. He says, okay, we'll start doing this over the phone. Here's my phone number. Call me 10 o'clock Tuesday morning. And I'm grateful because that's the way God works. This guy who sponsored a lot of people was bending his schedule for me so he could help me. And so he started taking me through this big book of Alcoholics Anonymous over the phone because I couldn't drive anywhere without asking somebody for a ride or getting on a bus or what have you. And he started with me on the title page here, right here, of Alcoholics Anonymous, and this is almost 10 years ago, but he had me write that circle and triangle, and he explained what the circle and triangle was, he explained to me also that the very first sentence is that the story of how many thousands of men and women have recovered from alcoholism, he said, that's the first promise in this book. And he started taking me through this work. And we started with the prefaces. We read all the prefaces, over the phone, and especially the first preface. And I'll read a little bit of that if you have your book. The forward to the first edition, I'm sorry. In that first paragraph, it says, we of Alcoholics Anonymous are more than 100 men and women who have recovered from a seemingly hopeless state of mind and body. To show other alcoholics precisely how we have recovered is the main purpose of this book. For them, we hope these pages will prove so convincing that no further authentication will be necessary. We think this account of our experience will help everyone to better understand the alcoholic. Many do not comprehend that the alcoholic is a very sick person. And besides, we are sure that our way of living has advantages to all. And my sponsor explained to me, and I wrote on the bottom, this is our text. Mm-hmm. And he explained to me what precisely meant, and what specific and clear cut and exactly meant. Mm-hmm. And because there's no fooling around here. If you want to get well, the instructions are here, and we're going to follow them. We went on to the doctor's opinion. And he actually read, with a couple of our chapters, he actually read them to me over the phone, and he would pause and explain things to me because I was still in a fog. You know, I'm sober now about 4 months, but I'm white-knuckling it too because I know I can't drink because I'm going to get thrown out of the house and I have nowhere to go. So I'm a very willing student, believe me. And so we started off with the doctor's opinion. And I'll drop down to the second sentence there. As a well-known doctor, chief physician at a nationally prominent hospital specializing in alcoholic and drug addiction, gave alcoholics this letter, and I wrote in the parentheses under that, credibility. To whom it may concern, I've specialized in the treatment of alcoholism for many years, and he goes on to explain about in 1934, that was Bill Wilson, who was his patient, and how in the course of his third treatment, he acquired certain ideas about a possible means of recovery. As part of his rehabilitation, he commenced to present his conceptions to other alcoholics, impressing upon them that they must do likewise with still others. This has become the basis of a rapidly growing fellowship of these men and their families. This man and over 100 others appear to have recovered. Skipping to the very last sentence in that letter, it says, "You may rely absolutely on anything they say about themselves. Very truly yours, William D. Silkworth, M.D." Mm-hmm. So as I said, we went through the doctor's opinion. On page, the Roman numeral, page 28, that first full paragraph really describes us, I wrote in the margin. And many, many times when I've been invited to speak in an AA meeting, you can see my book, it falls right out into this page. We believe, and so suggested a few years ago, that the action of alcohol in these chronic alcoholics is a manifestation of an allergy, that the phenomenon of craving is limited to this class and never occurs in the average tempered drinker. These allergic types can never safely use alcohol in any form at all, and once having formed the habit and found they cannot break it, once having lost their self-confidence, their reliance upon things human, their problems pile up upon them and become astonishingly difficult to solve. And that, when I read that, it just was, it might have been in bright lights blinking, because that described me exactly before I had that grand mal seizure on June 24th. I had no hope. I wished I was dead. I would go to sleep at night and pray that I wouldn't wake up. I just hated myself and what I had become. I was ashamed of what I had done to my family in terms of letting them down. And I was that loser, and I became that loser, and I had no way out. And that really describes that condition for me. He also pointed out to me in that very bottom paragraph that men and women drink essentially because they like the effect produced by alcohol. The sensation is so elusive that while they admit it is injurious, they cannot, after time, differentiate from the truth from the false. To them, their alcoholic life seems the only normal one. They're restless, irritable, and discontented, unless they can again experience that sense of ease and comfort which comes once by taking a few drinks. And I could identify with that too, because all those decades, 30-plus years of drinking, I live to drink. Because I didn't know what I would do if I didn't have that drink. Because once that first scotch went down, it was like, of course, the problems piled up, and there was remorse later on. But I was obsessed with alcohol, and I was in the grips. I mentioned about my separation from alcohol, and now we're talking about what we're going through. With doctor's opinion, I could identify, as I said, with that. We went on to Bill's story. And Bill's story is chapter 1, page 1. But Bill's story is broken down in two parts, as you know. The first 9 pages is Bill's story. And page 9 to 15 is actually Bill's conversion. 1 through 9 ends with, chapter 9 is with when Bill meets Abby Thatcher, who was his childhood friend, who used to drink with Bill and be like Bill, and now Abby had a solution, and he was bringing it to Bill, if Bill would have it. Bill was really surprised, but it awakened something in him, particularly about God, because then Abby Thatcher would talk to him about religion, because if Bill asked him, "Come on, what's this?" Because Bill tried to push a drink to him across the table, and Abby said, "No, don't want it." "Why?" He says, "I've got religion." And of course, then Bill went off. And the thing that got Bill was when Abby said, why don't you think about your own concept of God?" And that made a difference to Bill, rather than the God of his childhood, where his perceived notions were and his belief systems, that kind of opened the door a little bit for him. So that was a monumental point for Bill. So my first assignment, or one of my first assignments from my sponsor, was to write how I, in the first 9 pages, how I identified with Bill, if I did. Bill's story, similarities between my alcoholism and how Bill recounts his story in pages 1 through 9. I can identify with Bill, what he was like and how alcohol became such an obsession that he became the center of every day around a drink. There are many similarities in my own life. Pages 1 through 9, I put an asterisk in 21 places and underlined several phrases and whole sentences. But when I began drinking beer in high school, my use of alcohol progressed gradually over several years. College, binge drinking, and occasional blackout, being pulled over by the cops while driving drunk and luckily not getting arrested, being told to take it easy instead. Just one of many warnings about the road I was heading on, but back then, drinking was fun. Everybody did it. It was normal. Over the years, I've been told many times by friends and family that I might have a drinking problem. I gradually began to see it myself. In time, I would buy beer, then scotch, and much later vodka at different liquor stores so people wouldn't notice how much I was drinking. I began to crave alcohol. I would get the shakes. I needed to have a few drinks before sitting down to pay bills because if I didn't, my hands would shake when I was writing checks. I would crave alcohol and come to hide a bottle or two of vodka in the trunk of my car and elsewhere in the house. My denial was the worst. The downward spiral of I don't drink too much, not true. I can stop when I want, not true. It won't affect my health, very much not true. All those lies came home to roost. It took years of concern for my family and friends, losing my job and a grand mal seizure on June 24th to bring me to my knees. I can identify with Bill's story and how I got to where he was, with no hope and no way out. I too hit bottom. I need no more examples and no more proof that my life is unmanageable and I am powerless over alcohol. I'm thankful that God whispered in my ear years ago and said, save this, because you never know when you're going to do this. My workbook when I was going through the steps with my sponsor, I'm grateful to have that. Hopping on to, if we could, to There Is a Solution. Those first two pages of There Is a Solution is what kind of was my, what drew me to AA. Because, as I said, you know, I was white-knuckling it. I knew I couldn't drink. I had nowhere else to go. I didn't have very much hope at all. And yet, I would go to AA meetings, and everybody was smiling and happy and welcoming me, of all people, which I just could not fathom at all. So I'd like to read, if I could, just a little bit on that first page in Chapter 2. We're average Americans. All sections of this country and many of its occupations are represented, as well as many political, economic, social, and religious backgrounds. We're people who normally would not mix, but there exists among us a fellowship, a friendliness, and an understanding which is indescribably wonderful. We are like the passages of a great liner the moment after rescue from a shipwreck, when camaraderie, joyousness, and democracy pervade the vessel from steerage to captain's table. Unlike the feelings of the ship's passengers, however, our joy in escape from disaster does not subside as we go our individual ways. The feeling of having shared in a common peril is one element in the powerful cement that binds us, but that in itself would never have held us together as we are now joined. The tremendous fact for each one of us is that we have discovered a common solutions, and I put in the margin the 12 steps. We have a way out which can be we can absolutely agree upon, which can join in brotherly and harmonious action. This is the great news this book carries to those who suffer from alcoholism. And on the bottom, towards the bottom of the following page, it says, talks about the psychiatrists who deal with alcoholics and pull their hair out because they can't reach us and can't do us, no matter all the lecturing about you can't drink and it's going to kill you. Says, but the ex-problem drinker who has found this solution, who is properly armed with the facts about himself, can generally win the entire confidence of another alcoholic in a few hours. Until such an understanding is reached, little or nothing can be accomplished. That the man who is making the approach, who has had the same difficulty, obviously knows what he's talking about, that his whole deportment shouts at the new prospect that he is a man with a real answer, that he has no attitude holier than now, nothing whatever except a sincere desire to be helpful. There are no fees to pay, no axes to grind, no people to please, no lectures to be endured. These are the conditions we have found most effective. After such an approach, many take up their beds and walk again. And that was such a draw for me, because going to that workshop and seeing that man up there, very soft-spoken, who was talking about the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, just calmly and quietly, with confidence and with compassion and love. I knew that this guy had an answer, and I wanted what he had. And I'm grateful that God brought me to AA. Further on here in their solution, on page 1920, it talks about the types of drinkers. You know, the moderate drinker who has a little trouble in giving up alcohol, of liquor entirely, if they have a good reason for it, they can take it or leave it. That certainly wasn't me. Then they have a certain type of hard drinker. He may have had the habit badly enough to gradually impair him physically and mentally. It may cause him to die a few years before his time, but if sufficiently strong reason, ill health, falling in love, change of environment, or a warning from a doctor becomes operative, this man can stop or moderate, although he may find it difficult and troublesome, and maybe even need medical attention. That wasn't me either, because he had power and control over alcohol. But what about the real alcoholic? He may start off as a moderate drinker. He may or may not become a continuous hard drinker, but at some stage of his drinking career, he begins to lose all control of his liquor consumption, and once he starts to drink. I bring that up because in the next paragraph is another thing that popped out to me in neon lights. Here's a fellow who has been puzzling you, especially in his lack of control. He does absurd, incredible, tragic things while drinking. He is a real Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde. That jumped out for me because my girlfriend of many years in San Diego, who suffered through my alcoholism and my drunken behavior, I bought a condo and she was actually living with me for a while. And so many times I would be drunk and argumentative about this or that, or mad and always remorseful the next day and apologetic. And I remember one time in particular, later on in my career with this pharmaceutical company, that I was ranting and raving in the living room, drunk, of course, that how I hate my effing job, I'm being passed over for promotions, and I just hate life. And she would be sitting right where you are, sir, but by the fireplace with her head down, not saying a word. And that struck a chord with me, and I remember the next morning being quietly apologizing and being remorseful, and she said, "David, I love you, and you're the nicest man I ever met, but when you drink, it scares me. You're like Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde." Mm-hmm. And that really hit me in the ear. So I could identify so much with their solution. Towards the back of their solution, there's a key player. On page 26, a certain American businessman who had ability, good sense, and high character. For years, he had floundered from one sanitarium to another. He had consulted the best-known American psychiatrist. Then he had gone to Europe, placing himself in the care of the celebrated physician, the psychiatrist, Dr. Carl Jung. That gentleman was Roland Hazard. Roland Hazard is key to us in Alcoholics Anonymous because in History and Archives Committee, we identify him and his meeting with Dr. Carl Jung as the first of four founding moments of Alcoholics Anonymous, because in those meetings with Dr. Jung, who he could not understand why, even spend all this money and went through all this treatment, how he could not stop drinking, and Carl Jung told him pretty much that you're screwed, there's no hope for you, and he said, "Is there absolutely nothing?" And he said, "Well." Exceptions, and next page 27, exceptions in cases such as yours have been occurring since early times. Here and there, once in a while, alcoholics have had what are called to be vital spiritual experiences. To me, these occurrences are phenomena. They appear to be in the nature of a huge emotional displacements and rearrangements. Ideas, emotions, and attitudes, which were once guiding forces of the lives of these men, are suddenly cast to one side, and a completely new set of conceptions and motives begin to dominate them. In fact, I've been trying to produce some emotional rearrangements within you. With many individuals, the methods which I employed are successful, but I've not been successful with an alcoholic of your description. So Roland Hazard left there thinking, there's no hope for me, but Roland Hazard, they joined the Oxford group, and Roland Hazard stayed sober. He didn't become a member of Alcoholics Anonymous, but he stayed sober. And he was one of the founding members of Allied Chemical, a very successful businessman. But he brought the message to Abby Thatcher, and Ed, we brought the message to Bill Wilson, and Bill brought the message to Dr. Bob, of course. So that's one of our founding moments. And more about alcoholism, just a few things I'll need to pop out. Now, we spent a lot of time, my sponsor and I, and more about alcoholism because this hits the mind. And I've come to realize that the mind is the culprit. My mind's a predator. My sponsor says so many often, and I say it now myself, that my mind wants me dead. It'll settle for me drunk. That mind, that little kid is always whispering to me that I'm a loser. They don't mean that. They're just saying that to be nice. You're never going to amount to anything. That's the same little whispering that's telling me it's going to be different this time. You know, don't drink beer. Drink something else. Don't go with those people. Go to a different bar and all that. It never was different, ever. Always lying. It's a predator. Wants to be dead. And we spent a lot of time in more about alcoholism. And there's several pages throughout this entire chapter where, again, things just pop out that I could identify with. And I guess that's why my sponsor had me do this. I asked him years later, why did we spend so much time, you know, early on before getting into amends and all that stuff? He said, you know, were you trying to determine whether or not I was an alcoholic? He says, no. He says, I wanted you to see if you were an alcoholic. Because I think it was pretty obvious to everybody. And I look back and I said, oh, okay. Because I followed all those assignments and I did everything that I was asked to do very willingly because I wanted to get out from under this. And I could see that, yes, as I indicated earlier, I'm a hopeless alcoholic. And without the help of the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous and God, there's no hope for me. The other thing about more about alcoholism that I like is that whereas earlier on in Bill's story I was writing about how I identify because I drank like that and I did those things, in more about alcoholism I was writing, yeah, I think like that. Mm-hmm. That's exactly the way my mind thinks. It's going to be different this time. What do you mean I can't drink moderately? If I don't drink for a while, I'll be okay. And of course, theory is debunked in this chapter as well. It's pointed out very clearly that if you're an alcoholic and you're drinking, and if you quit, you could quit for 20 years. If you go back again, you're right back to where you started again, because it's just lying in wait and waiting for you. Abstinence is no cure for alcoholism. There is no cure for alcoholism, but you can recover if you follow these simple steps and follow some new disciplines in your life. And those are great disciplines to follow because your entire life does change. So, again, grateful for the program. Let's see. Because I go back to, there are two long stories in here. One is about a guy named Jim, who's had an automobile agency, and he starts on page 35. I don't know who Jim was. I don't know if he was a composite of other people or not, but I can identify with Jim, the crazy thinking. How Jim, who used to... He inherited an automobile agency, and now he is working for a guy in that same automobile agency, and he has a resentment about that. And he goes off and decides to look for somebody he can talk to about a car or maybe sell a car to, and he stops to have lunch. And looking at page 36, here's where the ambush comes from that thinking mind. I sat down at a table and ordered a sandwich and a glass of milk. Still no thought of drinking. I ordered another sandwich and decided to have another glass of milk. Here it is. Suddenly, the thought crossed my mind that if I were to put an ounce of whiskey in my milk, it wouldn't hurt me in a full stomach. I ordered a whiskey and poured it in the milk. I vaguely sensed that I was not being any too smart, but felt reassured as I was taking the whiskey on a full stomach. The experiment went so well, I ordered another and poured it into the milk. It didn't seem to bother me, so I tried another. And thus started one more journey to the asylum for Jim. Mind is always lying to me. He had much knowledge about himself as an alcoholic, and yet for all reasons for not, and all the reasons for not drinking were entirely pushed aside by the favor of a foolish idea that he could put whiskey into a glass of milk. And later on, Fred. Now, I know who Fred is. Fred is a guy named Harry Brick, and he's from Montclair, New Jersey. Fred's story is in the first edition of Alcoholics Anonymous. It's called A Different Slant. It's a very short story. And then back here we have awesome stories in the fourth edition that I have. Fred's story, or Harry Brick's story, is very short. And pretty much he says that anybody can get this disease, even a successful businessman like myself who thought I could handle it with all the knowledge in my head and all my education, but no. There's no respecter of persons at all. And park bench or park, or yeah, whatever, Park Avenue. Avenue. There you go. You know what I mean. Thank you. No respecter of persons. It can happen to anybody. And he was there to attest to it. I could identify with Fred too, how that little nagging thought whispering in your ear that it's going to be different this time, it's going to be different this time. Don't listen to them. Ah, what do they know? You know, and always a lie, always a lie. Hopping forward to We Agnostics, which of course is all about step two. I didn't have any resistance to step two because I believe in God. I've always believed in God as a little kid. My mom, I remember when being in the backyard and she would be putting washing the clothesline, you know, to dry, and she would talk to me about Jesus and all, and I would ask her questions and all, and I knew that God loved me, and I know he would take care of me, and he would always look out for me, and so I had no problem about there is no God. My problem was that I convinced myself that God was a punishing God, because the way I behaved, that there's going to be dues to pay. And my God, in my mind, became somebody with a baseball bat just waiting for me to step out of line, and I was afraid. And added to that, the experiences of growing up and not being able to go to church and feeling less than about that, it was just that added to that, boy, God's mad at me because I didn't go to church and all that. And this chapter helped me a lot because while I didn't have any doubt about the existence of God, it showed me that God loves me. I already mentioned to you a couple parts in the book that really jumped out at me, very, very clearly because of my own experience, the things that happened exactly to me too. But my very favorite paragraph in the book Alcoholics Anonymous is on the bottom of page 46. Much of our relief, to our relief, we discovered that we did not need to consider another's conception of God. Our conception, however inadequate, was sufficient to make the approach and to effect a contact with him. As soon as we admitted the possible existence of a creative intelligence, the spirit of the universe underlying the totality of things, we began to be possessed with a new sense of power and direction, provided we took other simple steps. Here it is. We found that God does not make too hard terms for us, for those who seek him. To us, the realm of spirit is broad, roomy, all-inclusive, never exclusive or forbidding. To those who earnestly seek, it is open, we believe, to all men. And that was drilled into me by my sponsor, and it just washed away all those doubts and fears about God being there with a baseball bat waiting for me to step out of line. And I was taught instead that God is all love and no opposite, period, all love. And when I screw up, he knows I'm screwing up, but when I seek his forgiveness and his help, he's right there. He's right there. And that comforted me greatly, and it helped me in my relationship with God. And later on, we talked in later weeks about how I came back to God, thanks to Alcoholics Anonymous, but that was a pivotal part for me right there. Let me you see. There's a little paragraph on page 50 about on We Agnostics that kind of sums up, makes the case, if you would. It says, there are thousands of men and women, worldly indeed. They flatly declare that since they have come to believe in a power greater than themselves, to take a certain attitude toward that power, and to do certain simple things, there has been a revolutionary change in their way of living and thinking. In the face of collapse and despair, in the face of the total failure of their human resources, thinking back to me before that seizure, they found that a new power, peace and happiness and sense of direction flowed into them. This happened soon after they wholeheartedly met a few simple requirements, and I put in the bottom steps 4 through 9. Once confused and baffled by a seeming futility of existence, they show the underlying reasons why they were making heavy go of life. Leaving aside the drink question, they tell us why living was so unsatisfactory. They show how the change came over them. When many hundreds of people are able to say that the consciousness in the presence of God is today the most important fact of their lives, they present a powerful reason why one should have faith. So, powerful stuff. I'd like to go ahead to, before I jump go into the next chapter, and then I'm going to finish, but on page 52, because that really sums up for me, and I think for many of us, certainly for me, the unmanageability of me when I'm white-knuckling it without a solution and trying to stop drinking on my own and with no program and no help from any higher power. It's such a, those bedevilments are so powerful. We had to ask ourselves why we shouldn't apply to our human problems the same readiness to change our point of view. We were having trouble with personal relationships. We couldn't control our emotional natures. We were prey to misery and depression. We couldn't make a living. We had a feeling of uselessness. We were full of fear, and we were unhappy. We couldn't seem to be of real help to other people. Was not the basic solution of these bedevilments more important than whether we should see newsreels of lunar flight? Of course it was. When we saw the problems, saw others solve their problems by a simple reliance upon the spirit of the universe, we had to stop doubting the power of God. Our ideas did not work, but the God idea did. I'd like to hop forward a little bit to how it works. Just the beginning, just up to the third step prayer. I absolutely love beginning of chapter 5. And we were so many meetings, I think many of us that were started by reading beginning of chapter 5, you know, how it works. And in those three pages, it describes Alcoholics Anonymous. Who we are, who we can help, what we need to do, what kind of mindset and commitment we need to make if we really want to be out from under this burden and this torment from alcohol. I used to be asked so many times, why do you go to so many AA meetings? Do you go to feel better or to get better? And I know that they come to meetings like this, where we talk about the solution, we talk about the program, the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, I'm here to get better, not feel better for about 20 minutes until the whispers start coming in again and all the voices. That this is where the solution is, and this is where my pathway to my higher power and for understanding better what he would have me do here on earth is and where it lies. The other part that's so important for me after the beginning there about how it works is the description of self-will run riot. It's so key because you see how I marked up my book so much. But it talks about the actor in the play. The first requirement is that we're convinced that any life run on self-will can hardly be a success. That perhaps we were almost always in collision with someone or somebody, even though our motives were good. Most people try to live by self-propulsion. Each person is like an actor who wants to run the whole show. We're ever trying to arrange the lights, the ballet, the scenery, and the rest of the players in his own way. If his arrangements would only stay put, if only people would do as he wished, the show would be great. Now, I'll not read the whole thing, but you can see in pink there. Mm-hmm. It was suggested to me at a meeting I went to in Summit when I was newly and just starting to go through the steps about Folks Anonymous by a gentleman. And he said, what I did with my book is I put my name and everywhere we referred to that actor, you know, the guy that wanted to direct everything. Mm-hmm. And so you can see, if everybody did as David wished, the show would be great. Everybody, including David, would be pleased. Life would be wonderful. And trying to make these arrangements, David may sometimes be quite virtuous. He might be kind, considerate, patient, generous, even modest and self-sacrificing. On the other hand, David could be mean, egotistical, selfish, and dishonest. But as with all humans, David is more likely to have varied traits. What usually happens, the show doesn't come off very well. David begins to think life didn't treat him right. David decides to exert himself more. David becomes on the next occasion even more demanding or gregarious. Or gracious, I'm sorry, as the case may be, and on. So I could identify by putting myself in there. That's me. When I'm walking around and I've got a resentment about something, it's all about me. You know, you got to go my way. Who am I but a speck? I'm here to do God's will. I'm here to help people as He points me in that direction. And so I really love this part about how it works. The last thing was on the third step prayer is that my sponsor, I think as probably as many do, had me write out the third step prayer and then write out the third step prayer in my own words to make it more my prayer, which was helpful. And the last thing I'll say about that, I mentioned about my sponsor taking me through this work over the phone, most of it. I joined that home group where he was from, and I'm a member of that home group now. So oftentimes I would get rides early to the meeting, and then we would sit for a half hour before the meeting started, and then we would actually work face to face, which was good, better than being, you know, a voice on the phone. But I'm so grateful to Alcoholics Anonymous. This sacred place saved my life, hopeful and prayerful that God will guide me to bring you the message that he would have me bring. That's all I got.
Thank you.